From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR Sports Show, Only a Game. 4 decades of frustration ended this week for fans of the Golden State Warriors, who captured the NBA title for the first time since 1975. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with one happy Warriors fan who's held season tickets since 1962. Also, the dangers of overtraining for ultramarathons, and just in time for Father's Day weekend, a baseball dad reflects on fatherhood as his son embarks on a pro career. Also coming up, Al Michaels talks about Lake Placid, ice motorcycling on Wide World of Sports, and why he became a broadcaster.
Ebbets Field was just another most wonderful place. So I walk in at 6 years old with my father, and I'm mesmerized. And it's the first thing I can remember in life. And I knew somehow I had to be able to find something to get me to Ebbets Field every day of my life.
Stay tuned. Computer hacking has hit Major League Baseball. The FBI is investigating several employees of the St. Louis Cardinals in connection with the hacking of the Houston Astros. Cardinals owner Bill DeWitt Jr. has blamed the breach on, quote, roguish behavior within his organization and promised that those responsible will be held accountable. Roguish might not cut it with the criminal justice system. We'll talk more about the biggest scandal to hit the sports world since the arrest of more than a dozen FIFA officials in this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know, our weekly discussion of the sports news you may or may not have missed. I'm joined this week by NFL Network correspondent Andrea Kramer and sports writer Eric Malinowski. Welcome to you both.
Hello, Bill.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And Andrea, you're up first.
Well, I want to actually talk about this hacking scandal, but can the three of us just agree on one thing? Can we please not attach the word gate to this?
You got my vote.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Are we cool? Can that be the groundwork? All right. Are you cool with that, Eric?
You have my solemn prompts.
Two things come to mind for me here. How is the new baseball commissioner going to handle this? Harken back to Adam Silver, who was hired in February of 2014 and a mere 2 months later had a major crisis when he had the Donald Sterling situation, the TMZ released recording. 2 months later, basically Silver bans him from the game. A huge decision. Rob Manfred, new commissioner succeeding Bud Selig. He has this hacking scandal. And he is going to have to deal with it ultimately after the feds probably put some people in jail. And bottom line, guys, how strange is it that these commissioners have to basically discipline the men they technically work for, the owners of these teams?
Yeah, I wonder if this is going to be this much of a test for Commissioner Manfred, really, because the FBI is involved. How many people are going to care what the commissioner says after the FBI comes down with their judgment and the criminal justice system gets involved? And plus, they put it up on the internet. I mean, this was obviously an attempt to embarrass the general manager, not an attempt to enhance the ability of the Cardinals to play great baseball. Otherwise, they would have kept it secret.
And of course, the other issue is the gentleman who left, remember, the Cardinals, Jeff Lunau, left in 2011. He went to the Astros, and he has talked about how he was allowed to take, quote, residual intellectual property with him when he went, which is supposed to be what's in his head.
I was going to say, that's his memory.
I mean, if you're going to leave a job, you're going to leave what you learned, and you're going to bring what you learned with you to the next one. So.
Eric, has this got you on pins and needles?
I can't believe they didn't do the whole Men in Black memory erasure thing during his exit interview.
That would have been very cool.
You know, on some level, I can't help but wonder if this isn't a blessing in disguise for Rob Manfred, because I remember everybody was talking about Adam Silver after the Donald Sterling thing came out, and he had a bunch of little things on his plate. But because he was able to handle the Donald Sterling incident in the end with such authority and almost universal praise, Manfred is sort of facing the same thing. But I think on some level, if he can take this scandal and he can nail it in such a way that the public universally approves of what he's done, that's going to give him a lot of cachet going forward as he tries to deal with some of these other things, these other wrinkles that he's trying to iron out.
By the way, and Eric mentioned blessing in disguise. You know who I really think this is a blessing in disguise for? The NFL and the Patriots and Tom Brady.
Because
Brady's got his hearing next week on Deflategate, so there's some other scandal in sports we can talk about.
Eric, let's move on to your story. What have you got for us?
So voting is underway right now for the 2015 Major League Baseball All-Star Game in Cincinnati. And as it stands right now, the American League champion, Kansas City Royals, if voting ended today, they would be sending 8 starters to the All-Star Game. They have the best record in the American League. So obviously there's a lot of excitement around the team. However, some of the selections are a little bit peculiar, most notable being second baseman Omar Infante, who is currently batting .228, and by some advanced metrics is perhaps the worst offensive player in the American League, and perhaps baseball itself. Major League Baseball, for its part, says that there's nothing especially insidious going on here, that they regularly throw out blocks of votes. I think they said they threw out some 65 million votes out of the 390 million that have been cast so far. But, you know, the Major League Baseball All-Star Game is not an exhibition the way it used to be. Home field advantage in the World Series now hinges on whoever wins this game.
As far as I'm concerned, this is how the commissioner could establish that he's a heck of a good commissioner, at least a better one than Bud Selig. Can the idea that home field advantage in the World Series depends on the All-Star break? It's an exhibition. It's always been an exhibition. Beyond that, if you're going to have the fans vote, you got exactly what you asked for.
What's going on in Missouri? can we just say that? What's happening in Missouri? But look, All-Star games are just these ridiculous exhibitions. I mean, look, the worst, I think, is the Pro Bowl.
Absolutely. I gotta agree with you there.
Yeah, there's nothing. I kind of like that they are actually playing for something and that the All-Star game matters.
I have one more theory as far as this goes.
Ooh, let's hear.
The Kansas City metropolitan area is one of very few in the country that has access to Google Fiber, which is the ultra high speed internet network. The only two metro areas that have a baseball team and Google Fiber is Atlanta, which is historically, you know, not the most rabid fan base, you know, with their history of not selling out playoff games and whatnot. And the other one is Kansas City. So I think when you add it all up with the excitement of a pennant and the best record in the league, and the fact that they have the fastest internet service perhaps in the entire country, and you have a system that's not going to verify email addresses, maybe it was all destined to happen this year. Maybe we should have seen it coming.
Kudos to Eric. He's such a millennial, huh?
Yeah, I'll say. I don't even know what he's doing. I completely right. tuned out. I had no idea what he was talking about.
I just want that internet service.
All right, it's time for me to get on to the third of our stories, and my story involves the curse of great potential. The U.S. women's soccer team may be feeling it right now. They finished at the top of their group, allegedly the group of death. They gave up one goal in three games, and no matter, The Guardian commented, USA's attacking prowess isn't what it used to be. And Mashable summarized the U.S. team's performance with one word, meh. So, if they hadn't been laboring under the curse of great potential, wouldn't soccer fans be happier with how well the U.S. team came out of the group stage, won it, and is moving along?
Throw out the style points. Forget about it. Did you win the game? Is that the goal? Is the goal to win the game? In 2011, they did not win that last game against Japan. And so I understand the pressure, but the idea that they have to win by a certain amount or a certain way, I just think is just ridiculous.
Eric?
You know, I do think that there's a little bit of, as you alluded to, Bill, a little bit of psychology at play here. At the same time, I was on my couch when Abby Wambach scored the goal against Nigeria. And I was screaming. I was going nuts. This is a heck of a team. They're ranked number two by FIFA in the world. Just enjoy the play and enjoy the ride as long as it lasts.
My guests for the three stories you should know have been the NFL Network's Andrea Kramer and sports writer Eric Malinowski. Thank you to both of you.
Such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
The Golden State Warriors topped LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers on Tuesday to claim their first NBA title in 40 years. The four-decade wait must have felt especially long for Golden State fan Gary Liss. As the Warriors season ticket holder of longest standing, he sat through thousands of games, most of them losses. On Friday, the day of the Warriors' victory parade, I spoke with Gary Liss and the Wall Street Journal's Ben Cohen, who has written about the Warriors' most loyal fan. I started by asking Gary why, in 1962, the year the Philadelphia Warriors moved to San Francisco, he decided at the age of 19 to buy a season ticket.
Well, someone told me I can go watch the Warriors, and they put me in the front row. In those days, it was just a few dollars, and I went, and I enjoyed it. And someone said, you can have this as a season ticket, and I'm a big basketball fan then, and so I did it, and I've been there ever since.
Ben, the Warriors did win the championship back in 1975. Things went downhill for the franchise after that, right?
Things were not very good for the Warriors. In fact, you know, even between 1975 and 1995, things weren't good. Between 1995 and 2006, the team didn't make the playoffs for a single season, which is the second longest playoff drought in the history of the NBA behind only the Los Angeles Clippers. And let's be honest, this is the Clippers. I'm not even sure that they count in terms of bad NBA streaks. So things were not very good for Golden State.
Gary, during that exceptional stretch of futility between 95 and 2006, did you ever consider maybe not renewing your season tickets?
No, never. It was a long drought, but, you know, something. I got to see great basketball and great athletes and had a good seat, and I enjoyed it. And as I've told Ben, every game I go to start 0-0, so you always have a chance.
Gary, you missed some games this winter while you recovered from pneumonia. Was it hard being away from Oracle Arena?
Well, I was pretty sick, so, yeah, it was hard to not go. But I watched every game on TV, never missed a game.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoy it on TV. I couldn't go out until the bitter end.
Well, of course, you got back for Games 2 and Games 5 of the finals. What was that like?
Fabulous. It was. It's a different thing when they get to the championship. Very, very noisy. You pretty much have to stand up the whole game, which I wasn't used to. But I enjoyed it, and it was fabulous.
Ben, you watched Game 6 with Gary. What was it like to watch the NBA Finals with, as you write, the craziest, most loyal Bay Area fan?
Gary was incredibly calm, which I think that he would tell you. I didn't know if he was going to be fidgety or nervous or anxious, but as his wife Terry said, it was almost as if he was in shock when they won. I don't know, Gary, if that has worn off or if it has sunk in, as you said it might, but it almost felt as if they had won any other game and not their first NBA championship in 40 years.
Well, Gary, I'm confused now. Was Ben seeing you in shock, or was he simply seeing a supremely confident fan?
No, I was inside. I was very, very nervous, obviously. And I just kept it in. I think when Ben finally left, I kind of let it all out. And since then, I've let more out. And I think sitting here watching the parade, all I can tell you is I have a lot of tears in my eyes.
Well, that's lovely. So it sounds as if your life, to some extent, really has been fulfilled by this.
This is great. This is my team. I mean, I'm a sports fan. I watch everybody, all kinds of sports, but this is my favorite one and the one I go to. And to me, I'm looking at the best athletes in the world.
Gary Liss has been a Warrior season ticket holder since 1962. Gary, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And Ben Cohen is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. You can link to his story for this Warriors season ticket holder. The 40-year wait for an NBA title is over at our website, onlyagame.org. Ben, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill. It was a pleasure.
For baseball-loving dads, few dreams can top the prospect of a son making his way to the big leagues. That's a scenario currently playing out for KJZZ's Mark Moran, whose son Spencer was drafted by the Tampa Bay Rays last year. In May, as Spencer was preparing to take the mound for the first time as a pro, Moran traveled from his home in Arizona to the Rays' extended training camp in Port Charlotte, Florida, with his wife Rochelle and their two daughters, Samantha and Kaylee. The Moran family tells their story in their own words.
Why are you so uptight?
What would lead you to believe that I'm uptight, Kaylee?
You've been pacing all morning.
I know that there's no reason to or sense in it, but it's probably just a dad thing. I probably think about the fact that he's a pro baseball player more than I should, and I dwell and brood about how's he doing. And I think he's doing pretty well.
How's it going? I'm Spencer Moran. I'm a pitcher in the Tampa Bay Rays organization.
So you started playing baseball...
I was about four, throwing the ball down the hallway in the house, not really knowing too much about the sport or anything like that.
I think your mom taught you to throw.
Yeah, she was the one who stuck the ball in my hand. Looking back on it now, I'm kind of frustrated she didn't put it in my left hand, but... It's okay. It worked out.
I was usually the coach in those early days. Was I a control freak?
You could say that. That'd be an understatement, probably.
Really?
This is T-ball, mind you, and we come in and it's, guys, we're down four runs. Spencer, guys, we need you all to get a hit so we can come back and win this game. And we're 4 years old and he's keeping score.
Man, we played a lot of baseball.
At the time, I didn't know whether I was going to be a pitcher or a hitter. Obviously, it was just playing the game. It was all the same, but I'd kind of do my own little routine that I'd made up, and I'd get dressed and wait for you to come home and go in the back, maybe hit off the tee or whatever, get ready for the game. I wanted to be just like those guys on TV, and one day I wanted to be out there. I wanted everyone to watch me doing what they do. You know, you taught me to never show my emotions on the field.
Yeah, I probably did most of the emotional stuff coaching, although I think I only ever got run from one game as a coach. Do you remember that game?
I mean, I can remember multiple games where you were run.
Shut up! I got run one time.
I remember you getting thrown out of a game one time. I was pitching in a summer league game. You were yelling at the umpire. You were actually a real mess, to be honest. The umpire turned around, threw you out of the whole complex.
You can say it. I embarrassed you.
Yeah, multiple times. Yeah, there's just that fine line where sometimes the dad pushes too much, and sometimes it's good for the dad to just step back and kind of let their son figure it out on their own. And there was a few times where you did that, too, where you just kind of said, all right, I mean, I know you're going to high school, and you have your coaches there, and I'm just going to kind of step back now. I'm not really going to coach you anymore. I'm just going to kind of back off and let you do your own thing, and that's also important.
The truth of the matter is, probably from the time you were 12, you knew far more about the game than I did. I just faked it.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
Here we have the mother of the clan.
Well, hello, Rochelle. What are you doing?
I am just cleaning up the kitchen after making one of my son's favorite meals and an apple pie, trying to give him an experience of home away from home while we're here. Just enjoying being his mom.
I don't really miss home. I mean, obviously, I like being at home with the family and eating home-cooked meals. But the dream drives me. Home kind of gets pushed to the back of my mind, and I'm always thinking about driving closer to my goal.
You know, I've never even asked you this, but how much did you play the game for me, and how much did you play the game for you?
That's a good question, you know. I always loved the game, and it was something I always wanted to do. Of course, I wanted to make you happy, but at the same time, I love the game, and it's definitely something I did for me, too.
What about now?
Now, I don't care what you think. It's all for me now.
Well, Spencer, you know I'm always there for you, right?
Yeah, you probably worry more about my issues than I do, actually.
I think that's my role. It's hard to watch you go. It's hard for you to be so far away, but I know you are where you need to be. And I'm looking forward to the ride and the rest of it.
Me too. Thanks for always being there for me and giving me everything I needed.
I hope I did. I love you, kid.
Love you too.
Mark Moran is Associate General Manager of News at KJZZ in Phoenix. Spencer Moran pitched well in his first start for the Rays' extended spring training squad, and on Wednesday he was assigned to the Princeton Rays, the club's high rookie ball team in West Virginia. This week's In Their Own Words feature was produced by Gary Wallach. Happy Father's Day. Ultramarathoners train hard, and they train a lot, and it's likely that until fairly recently, nobody involved with the sport had a problem with that. Of course one trains hard for a race that lasts all day and into the next and maybe into the day after that. But numbers of top ultramarathoners have now run out the other end of excellence and into exhaustion. Megan Brown wrote about that subject for Outside Magazine, and she joins me now from, well, outside. Megan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Overtraining syndrome sounds like something that must happen to anybody who puts in this kind of distance, but the symptoms range from somewhat distressing to terrifying. Or am I being melodramatic?
No, that's actually true. There are basically three levels of overtraining. And there's overtraining, which everybody has heard about. You maybe are really tired for a week after putting in a lot of miles for a marathon. Mm-hmm. There's non-functional overreaching, where you start to have some strange hormonal things going on. And then there's what I wrote about in the article, which is overtraining syndrome. And those symptoms are pretty terrifying. People have reported like profound exhaustion, sometimes the ability to not even get out of bed, muscle soreness that never really goes away, just the feeling of having like 7 cups of coffee, heart palpitations, loss of libido. Those are sort of the ones that you hear a lot.
How common are these symptoms? How common is overtraining syndrome?
So there aren't really any numbers to be able to answer that question very well. Overtraining syndrome is something that people have known about for quite a while, but you're only seeing more and more cases now that this sport is becoming more competitive. And you don't have to be an elite athlete to get overtraining syndrome. This can happen to anybody, which isn't really touched on in the piece. But in terms of numbers, nobody is really able to answer that question right now.
Has this syndrome been around long enough so that doctors know it when they see it, or are they still sort of operating in the dark?
It's been around for a long time. In fact, there's an old ancient Greek text that actually mentions something that sounds a lot like overtraining syndrome. Unfortunately, most sports medicine doctors don't see enough cases to be able to know what it is, and it often mimics other diseases. There's a disease called Addison's, which looks a lot like chronic fatigue, and so there are parallels with that. If an athlete tests with low testosterone or wacky blood levels, it could be... Doctors basically want to rule everything else out before they say it's overtraining syndrome, and a lot of doctors don't even know what it is.
Ultramarathoner Mike Wolf talked to you about the mind-body connection. Is he suggesting that part of what causes overtraining syndrome is mental exhaustion, or does the mental exhaustion result from the overtraining?
So he didn't suggest that as a connection that he had seen. It was actually something I asked him about because I was seeing this pattern with a lot of the runners that I talked to where they really did have this mental exhaustion component to it too. And one person that I spoke with talked a lot about flow states, which is when you're in this space of like absolute perfection. Runners experience this a lot, surfers experience this. It's like every single molecule of your being is focused on this athletic or creative endeavor. And a lot of these runners, it was almost as if they had been in a flow state for so long that they could no longer function in daily life with that. And so not being able to draw from that mental component, because to run 100 miles actually takes a lot of mental energy. Some people say it's about 75% mental and 25% physical. So they didn't have the mental energy or the physical energy, and they were kind of feeding off of each other.
Your article suggests that this syndrome, and I'm quoting now, is robbing a generation of top athletes of their talent. How big a threat is this to the whole sport of ultramarathoning?
If it's not checked soon, it could be a really big issue. Ultramarathoning is becoming a pretty legitimate sport, but unfortunately the regulations and also just the coaching and training component of it haven't really caught up with the speed that the sport is growing. So a lot of these guys, kind of the typical ultra training method has been just to run as much as possible. And if you do that, you might have 2 amazing years of running where you're top of your game, but it's not a very sustainable model of training. And there are some people out there. Jason Koop is an ultra running coach who's working with a lot of top athletes right now, who's really trying to rejigger that approach and have the athletes train at a much higher intensity, but much lower volume and take a lot more rest days. And there's some thinking in the ultra world that that may be the direction that the sport needs to go. But right now, it certainly hasn't caught up with the rate that this is occurring.
I may be just guessing here because my knowledge of ultramarathoning is not extensive, but it would seem to me that the kind of person who regularly runs 100 miles might come to believe, yeah, this could happen to somebody else, but it'll never happen to me.
For sure. Mike Wolf definitely believed that. I mean, he knew it existed, as did Kyle Skaggs and a number of other runners in the piece, but they all, you know, they'd had a bunch of great years and they trained hard and were racing well, and they really did have this feeling of, that can't happen to me. And I think people who don't race at the elite level also believe that. You know, they're not on the podium and they're not sponsored, so they assume that this can't really happen to them, but it actually can.
You can find a link to Megan Brown's article, Running on Empty, at onlyagame.org. Megan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
When 47,000 fans gather to watch a match, Chile's National Soccer Stadium is a raucous place. Located in Santiago, Estadio Nacional is currently the site of several games in the Copa America tournament, but even during intense international games, one section of the stadium always remains empty, a memorial to the deaths and suffering that happened there more than 40 years ago. David Wallstein wrote about the building's history for the New York Times this week. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with a bit of background about the stadium. It opened in 1938 and has hosted some pretty significant soccer matches.
Yes, the World Cup was held here in 1962, and there have been several Copa America, which is the championship of South America. They've been held here in 1955, 1991, and this year as well.
Estadio Nacional's place in Chilean history changed drastically in 1973 after a U.S.-backed military coup brought General Augusto Pinochet to power. Pinochet's forces began using the stadium as a prison camp that held an estimated 20,000 people. Please describe what things were like at the stadium at that point.
It was pretty darn awful. There were routine, regular beatings, torture, and just really horrible conditions, people blindfolded, hoods on their heads, and then called out one by one to be beaten or tortured. One of the gentlemen, Felipe Aguero, said that he saw people, he 100% certain that they must have died that very night from the beatings they endured. And they would spend either one day there in those barracks or were taken immediately then to the prison camp, the stadium. Aguero told the story that he was just beaten mercilessly on the way in the bus to the stadium, and then from there got worse. It was an awful moment in history.
The use of the stadium as a prison facility was interrupted by soccer. Tell me a little bit about that.
What happened was the coup was September 11th, 1973. And the stadium needed to be prepared for a World Cup qualifying match between Chile and the Soviet Union. So they knew they were going to have to eventually close it down and start preparing for the game. So the Soviet Union complained. They said, we're not going to play there. This stadium is a place of blood. And so FIFA, you know, we've all heard about FIFA lately, they said, all right, we'll investigate. And they claimed that they saw nothing untoward going on there. And Aguero said he saw the FIFA officials, and they were calling out to them, saying, hey, look at us. You know, we're here. And he said that the FIFA officials only seemed to care about the condition of the grass.
What was the result of that visit, finally?
I do know that they mandated that the game be played. And the Soviet Union said, forget it, we're not going, we're not playing there. But to make it even more farcical, FIFA said, well, Chile's going to have to score a goal. So they put on their uniforms, they lined up. There's video of this on YouTube. They waved to the crowd, and stands looked like they're about half full at that point, no longer prisoners, but fans. And then the Chileans sort of ran down the field as if it was a promotional video, kind of passing the ball amongst themselves about nine times, and then kicked it in the goal. And so they were awarded a 1-0 victory and a place in the World Cup.
The return of soccer to the stadium was not the end of their terrible experiences under the Pinochet regime.
No, it wasn't as if they were all just freed because they had to shut the stadium down as a prison camp. Almost all of them were sent to other prison camps. Rene Castro, who I spoke to, went to a prison camp in the north and spent 2 years there before he was finally able to be freed. And it was pretty much the same case for a lot of them. Eventually, when they did get out, most of them went into exile. In fact, I think every one of the ones that I spoke to went into exile. So it wasn't as if the horror only lasted 2 months. It lasted 2 months at that stadium.
Could you describe the section of the stadium that serves as a monument to the prisoners who suffered there?
It is really a ghostly place when there's a game there and Chile is playing and it's packed and everybody's screaming and yelling and they're all excited and the lights are on and all the focus is, you know, bright lights on the field. And then you look over there behind one of the goals, it's this very small section and it's lit up in this kind of yellow light and it's just this very somber, haunting image. These little wooden benches that are left exactly the way they were back then, with all the fans in there, all the excitement, all the celebration, to see that little reminder of the horror that took place there is a very sobering thing. But the Chilean government did a great job of reclaiming the stadium from its grisly past. When they overthrew Pinochet, it became a voting station for the first democratic presidential elections after the 17 years of dictatorship. And they've really been able to retake it from just being this horrible place that once was.
David Wallstein's article, In Chile's National Stadium, Dark Park Shadows Copa America Matches, appeared in the New York Times this week, and you can link to it at onlyagame.org. David, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Coming up on Only a Game, veteran broadcaster Al Michaels, believer in miracles, and ice motorcyclist. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Various U.S. government agencies have been hacked, of course. Lots and lots of retailers have been hacked. Tell me we shouldn't be equally concerned that the Houston Astros have been hacked.
Well, there's a lot of different things going on here. First of all, the FBI is involved, and they don't do this for practice. Okay, so somebody's going to the slammer behind this thing. Secondly, I mean, it seems to me that what got hacked and what got lifted and what got stolen and what got Edward Snowdened was their player evaluations. So, I mean, if you want to see the competitive effect this event had, I guess you got to wait till about 2024.
Well, let me try out on you my perception of this. This just feels to me like less the theft of proprietary information than a fraternity prank by some guys so dim that they didn't understand that the FBI would be interested.
I think there's a lot of that going on. I think there's a lot of, you know, the gentleman in Houston who was hacked was a former Cardinals executive who wasn't a particularly popular one, apparently. So, I mean, it's entirely possible people were sitting around and got bored because they ran out of Doritos and decided they would do something to kill some time on a Saturday night. But it's still some pretty serious stuff.
Does this mean we get Doritos as an underwriter henceforth?
It means we should immediately run all the computers and all the math nerds out of baseball and go back to, like, tobacco-chewing fat old ex-players.
On a slightly less frivolous note, does this week's news lead you to wonder whether other baseball teams and football teams and basketball teams are raiding each other's databases all the time?
Oh, I'm sure they are. I mean, it occurs in every other business and every other area in American life. There's no reason why it wouldn't occur here.
Charlie, since last we spoke, the NBA's best player was beaten by the NBA's best team. Is that shorthand a sufficient description of what the Golden State Warriors accomplished in winning their first championship in 40 years?
Yeah, there's no question. The Golden State Warriors were the best team in the NBA wire to wire this year. Steph Curry emerged as a legitimate superstar. But what LeBron James did with the ragtag collection of gypsies, tramps and thieves that he was playing with in Cleveland should go down in history as something. I don't know what. This guy picked an entire franchise up and carried it almost to the NBA title.
And thank you for the Cher reference. I'm quite sure that no other sports programs will pull that out this week. Tim Duncan of the San Antonio Spurs said this week that thanks to a dishonest financial advisor, he's out $25 million. Happily, he says the loss is not going to change his life in any way. That's quite a cushion Mr. Duncan has there, isn't it?
I was going to say, wow, $25 million? Let me go through the cushions on the sofa. I'll find that. Yeah, this is, of course, not the first time it's happened. It happened to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. It happened to half the National Hockey League back in the day. I mean, there isn't much to say, except there are crooks active in every area. Unless you're absolutely sure about the guy who's handling your money, he's liable to handle your money into being his money.
By winning their third Stanley Cup in 3 years, the Chicago Blackhawks have earned the right to be called a dynasty, at least according to some of the reporters that I've been reading. What do you think?
I think so. Well, Gary Bettman said it when he was presenting them with the Stanley Cup trophy. I'd like to point out, by the way, that I'm in Chicago now, and now twice in the last 5 years I've been caught in the Chicago Blackhawks victory parade, which has to be some kind of record.
They're going to ask you to come back next year, whether you have to or not.
It was a terrific series, by the way. If you liked hockey, the contrast of styles and the sheer determination of the Blackhawks was really something to behold.
Some fellow fond of arcane statistics has discovered that the last time the Blackhawks won the Stanley Cup on home ice was 1938, and the Chicago Cubs won the World Series. I assume Cubs GM Theo Epstein will be happy to hear that.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, that's stretching superstition a little bit too far even for me.
Cole Hammer, the brilliantly named 15-year-old golfer of whom we spoke a few weeks ago, shot a 77 in the first round at the U.S. Open on Thursday. That's three strokes better than the golfer who will remain unnamed, because if you can't shoot better than 80, we don't name you on this program. Not bad, huh?
No, that's terrific. It's a terrific story. Yeah, we can only hope that he manages to avoid the pitfalls of what it's like to being a 15-year-old golf phenom, because our most recent example of that has not ended particularly well.
Carolina Panthers left tackle Michael Orr said this week, quote, "People look at me and they take things away from me because of the movie." He was, of course, referring to the film The Blind Side, based on his early life. "I suppose this is why we should be glad that nobody is likely to make a movie of your life or mine."
Yeah, when you become a character in your own life and your life story becomes common property, you will pay a price for that. And I think he's seeing it. Plus the fact he's not a very good professional offensive lineman.
He was very good for a short time, though, in the pros, right?
Yeah, but he either got worn down or got bored, and his talents have eroded.
And finally, Charlie, there is brewing an international dispute between the Swiss and Venezuelan governments. Usually we ignore this sort of thing on Only a Game, but this kind of involves a sport. How so?
Sports! Actually, it involves the Swiss ambassador to Venezuela. Apparently, next to the Swiss embassy, there's a golf course. And, you know, golfers being what they are, I speak as one of them, you know, very often the ball doesn't go where you want it to go. And a lot of them have been going onto the grounds of the Swiss embassy, and the Swiss ambassador has warned the Venezuelans that if anybody inside the embassy gets hurt by a golf ball, it could very well violate the Vienna Convention regarding the sanctity of embassies. It would be very embarrassing to have a war break out between Switzerland and Venezuela.
Yeah, well, we've had the soccer war. It's probably the Gulf War coming
next.
Yeah,
but it's a long-distance war.
You're right.
I mean, it's, you know, it would be very hard to, for example, to hit a golf ball from Vienna to Caracas, even if you got a nice lift over the ocean.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Perhaps there is a sport that broadcaster Al Michaels hasn't brought us in his one-half-century career behind the microphone. Nah, probably not. He's done the one where they ride motorcycles on ice. He even suited up in leathers for it. More on that very soon. Anyway, he's got a book out, and it's titled You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. Al Michaels, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, thank you very much. And the one sport I have not done is soccer.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry to hear that.
Somebody told me recently that, hey, you know, you've done just about everything, so don't you want to do soccer before it's all said and done? And wouldn't you like to do the World Cup since it's become so big? And I responded by saying, since I've never been to a soccer game, I don't think I would like to end my career, at least figuratively speaking, by doing a soccer game. So that's out of the mix, Bill.
When you dressed up in leathers for that Motorcycles on Ice feature for ABC's Wide World of Sports, they didn't actually make you ride a motorcycle on ice, but it was close, right?
Well, it's probably as close as I have come to getting killed. I had just joined ABC. I was the new kid on the block on a staff that included the iconic figures Howard Cosell, Jim McKay, Frank Gifford, Keith Jackson. So I'm going to do anything. And I go to Insel, West Germany, small town in the Bavarian Alps, about halfway between Munich and Salzburg, Austria. And they have this event called Motorcycles on Ice, which is wild. It's a quarter-mile speed skating track covered with ice. And all of these Eastern Europeans, Bill, came out from, at that time, before the wall went down, Czechoslovakia, Poland, the Soviet Union, Hungary. And they decided, well, why don't we do something different? We'll have me open up the show instead of standing there with a mic and saying, hi, welcome to Motorcycles on Ice. Why don't I get on one of the motorcycles with spikes protruding from the tires, come down the straightaway, get off the bike with a mic, and welcome you to Wide World of Sports. So I say, fine, without telling the producer that I had never been on a motorcycle and I'd only really been on a Schwinn bike. And I had just recently, you know, taken the training wheels off of that. So the first thing they have to do is, you know, find me a uniform. I'm about, at that time, I'm 5'10". I probably weigh somewhere around 180. And they find a Soviet rider who's about 5'5 and a half and weighs 145. So for starters, I'm now trying to get into his leathers. So breathing became an issue. I have to think about what I'm going to say. I'm in my second or third show on Wide World of Sports. 15,000 people are in the stands, and I'm trying to figure out how the motorcycle works. So I don't know whether there's a gas pedal or what, and I realize, you know, it works with a clutch and an accelerator, but you do it with your hands. So at one point, I'm revving it up to the point where, I mean, it must be screaming at like 15,000 revolutions per minute, and I am ready to let the clutch go because I don't know what the clutch is. And fortunately, at that point, somebody grabbed my hand and made sure the clutch got engaged again. So that was the way I broke into Wide World of Sports, and fortunately, here I am to talk about it.
In You Can't Make This Up, you recall, among many other things, your first visit to Ebbets Field to see the Brooklyn Dodgers play. And one of the things that you remember most vividly is looking up into the press box. Really? Why weren't you looking at Gil Hodges, Pee Wee Reese, and Jackie Robinson?
I was looking at everything at that point, Bill. I was looking at the field and how unbelievably green the grass was. And the Dodger uniforms are, as Vin Scully has always described them, wedding cake white.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. There's signage on the outfield walls, and Ebbets Field was just, you know, the most wonderful place. So I walk in at 6 years old with my father, and I'm mesmerized. And it's the first thing I can remember in life, and thinking to myself, how can I come here every single day? And at some point, I remember looking into the press box and looking at the broadcast booth. And to think that all those years ago, the iconic Red Barber was there, a very good announcer by the name of Connie Desmond, and a young kid by the name of Vin Scully. I knew that that's what I wanted to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do exactly, but I knew somehow I had to be able to find something to get me to Ebbets Field every day of my life.
Al, you have brought people Super Bowls, the World Series, all manner of Olympic events, including, of course, the 1980 hockey game in Lake Placid between the U.S. and what was then the Soviet Union. And obviously, you've been terrific at these things because you've been employed for many, many years. Was there ever an event where you started talking and suddenly realized you were unprepared?
I can't say that that's ever happened because I won't allow it to happen, Bill. But, I mean, there have been events where I'll come on the air and you might slightly lose a train of thought. But not feeling prepared, no. I just would never let that happen.
The subtitle of your book refers to the perfect marriage of sports and television. But the coverage of sports on TV has changed so dramatically over the course of your career. It used to be all about ABC, NBC, and CBS. Then ESPN came along. And now there are channels devoted exclusively to one sport. That's probably even true of motorcycle racing on ice. Has the marriage to which you refer in that subtitle just gotten better and better over the decades?
Basically, yes. It used to be when it was on the three networks, there was a specialness for a show like Wide World of Sports, which was the first show to really take you overseas. Satellite technology was coming into play, and you could go behind the Iron Curtain, and it was one of the few shows that allowed you to do that. So what's happened with sports on television is there's so much more of it. For people who can't get enough of it, it's phenomenal. Some people who think, well, there's too much of it, I always tell them, hey, look, if you like sports but you feel there's too much of it, there's a little button, it's an on-off button, so turn it off. So just watch what you want. I mean, nobody's saying you have to listen or watch. So it's good and bad. I think HDTV is fantastic. I mean, to me, football is much better to watch on television than in person. Now, in person, at the stadium, you have a different experience. You have that communal experience with the fans, and you can go to the office the next day and say, I was at the game last night, and that gives you a certain cachet. But you can see the game about 100 times better on television.
I'm afraid this is going to seem like an inevitable question for a man who's been broadcasting sports for 50 years, but is there one event or even one moment that stands out as the most gratifying in your long career?
Well, I would say that in terms of the event itself, nothing could ever top the United States and the Soviet Union in Lake Placid on February 22nd, 1980, because that was the, as Sports Illustrated put it at the end of the 20th century, probably the greatest sporting moment in the United States in the 1900s. People still to this day talk about it. Those who remember watching it or having been there, they glow when they talk about it. In terms of a television production, It wasn't very good. And I would know that because I knew the technical issues that we had had at Lake Placid. So if I look at the event as a television production, below average. But nobody will ever know that, Bill, because when they say the Olympics in 1980, there's only one thing you're ever going to think about, and that's the U.S. against the Soviet Union. In terms of the event itself, Bill, nothing could top Lake Placid.
You write in the book that you don't agree with the contention that a tragedy like the earthquake that occurred during the 89 World Series, quote, puts things into perspective. You regard that as a cliche, and I think you're right, because we shouldn't allow ourselves to lose perspective. But I have to wonder, in retrospect, if you feel that just for a moment you lost perspective when you made that famous call at the end of the hockey game in Lake Placid and asked rhetorically, do you believe in miracles?
It's a good question. And, you know, I think in that particular case, first of all, the game is ending. I don't have anything scripted. And what happened with that is it came out of my heart. Somebody wrote it was the 9-year-old in me coming out, and I'll buy that. I think that's exactly what it was. And I must look, I love sports. I'm witnessing one of the most unbelievable upsets ever. It's happening in the Olympics. It's happening in our country. I have an audience that is rooting 99.99% for the U.S. team. So when the puck came out to center ice, the word that came into my mind was miraculous. I have no idea that 35 years later, you know, people still say, oh, we love him. Great. That's wonderful. And it's a nice coda. The players did it. I didn't do it. I mean, they all say to me, hey, you know, what a great line and all that. I'm going, hey, you guys did it. You guys won the game 4-3. I didn't. I'm just sitting there announcing the game. But it formed a nice climax to an event that most people just think about and revel over.
With L. John Wertheim, Al Michaels has written, You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. Al, thank you very much.
Bill, what a pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Crabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Michael Garth. Our intern is Joe Jacobs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallen. Our final word comes from sports broadcaster Al Michaels, who admits in his book and to me that he has never eaten a vegetable in his entire life.
I can look at a salad, but I can't eat one. So I think I've proven that man can live a while without eating a vegetable.
Well, no vegetables for 70 years, and you're still here to tell the story. Do you believe in miracles? I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.